Hello and welcome to another Lush Radio podcast. My name is Charlie Moores, and in this interview I'm discussing green politics with the now former Green Party leader Natalie Bennett. Natalie decided in May 2016, after 4 years in the role, to step down at the end of the summer. I met with her at the end of August, just days before she delivered a farewell speech to the Green Party conference, which paved the way to the election of Caroline Lucas and Jonathan Bartley, who became the first leaders of a Westminster party to undertake the role as a job share. Understandably, Natalie was rushing from one interview to another, and we talked in a rather noisy coffee shop at St Pancras railway station. Not the ideal location, perhaps, but as always, Natalie made great sense on a range of issues, and we hope listeners will forgive some background noise in this recording. Anyway, I began our conversation by asking Natalie when the official handover would be made and she would move from party leader to former party leader.
The official handover date is the 2nd of September when the new leader of the Green Party will be announced.
I probably shouldn't ask, but do you know who that is yet?
No, I don't know. The vote closed a couple of days ago, but we'll hear the results on the official time.
Natalie, thanks for fitting me in. I came into the restaurant here at St Pancras and you were deep in a meeting. I'm sure you have a full diary for the rest of the day, you know, after talking with me. So nothing's going to change very much for you, is it, when you step down?
No, I say I'm standing down as Green Party leader, but definitely not going away. And one of the things I love about politics is the variety. So I've just been talking to a campaigner who wants a new national litter strategy. He's very concerned about what councils, the government, the London Assembly can do about litter. In a couple of weeks' time, I'll be in Birmingham Jail doing a question time style debate for the prisoners in Birmingham Jail. So politics is definitely a varied role.
I was wondering, will you find time to write an autobiography, though? Is there an autobiography in the works?
Not exactly an autobiography, perhaps a memoir, you might say. I'm certainly planning to write a book about my 4 years as Green Party leader. I mean, it has been an amazing period. The Green Party is now four times the size it was when I first became leader. Of course, we were really struggling for publicity at the start, but then I was on the leader debates. And indeed, just yesterday, Molly Scott Cato was on the Today programme talking about tax. Then I was on Women's Hour talking about standing down as Green Party leader. So I think that day was something of a measure of how far we've come. Although, of course, we've still got a very long way to go fighting against our electoral system. You look at the fact that we got 1.1 million votes in the general election in 2015. And if we had a fair electoral system with a proportional system, people could vote for what they believe in and get it, we'd have 25 MPs. But of course, we've only got one at the moment with our current system. So one of the things I'll continue to talk about, campaign about, really ensure is on the national agenda is fair votes, people being able to vote for what they believe in and get it. Because I've been saying for 4 years as Green Party leader that our politics is broken. And I think since the referendum, that's now very painfully clear to everybody. And fixing the electoral system won't fix everything, but it's a very good start.
Is that going to happen, though? Because that would mean that the two parties that always have the power, Labour and the Conservatives, would potentially no longer have that power. So how would you persuade them to give it up?
Well, I think one of those parties, Labour, is certainly looking at this, and lots of Labour people, ranging across the Labour political spectrum, from Clive Lewis to Chukwuemunna, have very strongly come out in favour of electoral reform, proportional representation. And if you look at Labour, they got in Scotland in the 2015 about 40% of the vote and one seat. There's so many voters who are disenfranchised that even, there are Tories. I've been to lots of events for Make Votes Matter, and they always have a Tory there. And people who are Tories can look at perhaps their compatriots in northern cities, who perhaps maybe 20 or 30% of people in those cities might vote Tory, and they won't have a single councillor.
Yeah, but if the Scots, or the SNP anyway, go their separate way, then that would just leave the English. And the Conservatives, who kind of rely on English votes, aren't going to allow change if it means them losing power. I mean, even if it would mean a fairer system, as you say.
Well, I think what we're in a situation now is we haven't seen change. There's been no significant change in Westminster since women got the vote. That was 1918. So I think we're coming up to a nice, centenaries and nice anniversaries of points to finally reform things again. And if you look at lots of foreigners, looked at what happened around the referendum and after the referendum and were really shocked because they'd all been taught that politics in Britain never changes. And of course, that's why we saw such turbulence, why I think we saw the referendum result that we did. People are desperate for change. So there's a strong societal push out there. It's a century since we've seen significant reform. So I think when it comes, it will be pretty fast and it will be pretty big, the change that will happen. The unelected House of Lords, I do have a theory that possibly David Cameron is actually a secret electoral reformer, because really his last two lists of people he appointed to the House of Lords really couldn't have been more embarrassing if he tried.
So who's going to be leading this electoral reform? Will it be the Green Party, or is there an alliance with the Lib Dems ahead, perhaps?
Well, I think what we need to do the next election, whenever that is, what we need to do is elect a majority parliament that wants proportional representation. And that's why there's a lot of talk when I go around the country. A lot of people are talking about Progressive Alliance, or I think increasingly Progressive Alliances, because I think this is something that it's going to be very difficult, possibly impossible, to get a whole nationwide across all of the United Kingdom. It's all very complex. Politics in different places is very different. But what we could see is in counties, particular counties, particular cities, we might see parties on the generally progressive side of politics getting together and saying, how can we make sure that we get a parliament that will actually then deliver us fair votes? This really is the underlying issue in so much of British politics. The Labour Party is clearly, at least what would be in continental Europe, two parties uncomfortably pushed together. And if you look at the Tories, they're exactly the same. We've had a two-party system which is effectively broken down, but we're still stuck in first-past-the-post, the two-party system. Yeah. So we have to see the change. We have to keep talking about it, pushing for it. There's surveys showing the public want it. And just to pick up one of the arguments that you always get back in response, no, we didn't have a vote on proportional representation in 2011. That was the alternative vote AV referendum. Yeah. And AV is not a proportional system. And in fact, to demonstrate that, in Australia, which has an AV system, they've just had an election where the Green Party got 10% of the vote and still only won one parliamentary seat.
No, it's clearly a biased system at the moment. Natalie, there was a reason that I asked you a couple of minutes ago about an autobiography, and that was a question of leadership. And I wondered whether you thought whether it was more important for a politician to be liked, trusted, or respected.
Oh, liked, trusted, or respected. I think trust and respect, I'd pick the two out. I mean, obviously people, feel if someone's comfortable and cuddly, that's not necessarily related to respect and trust. I think possibly trust is the biggest thing that we have a real problem with in British politics at the moment. Yeah. If I had to pick one of those, I think trust is it. Because particularly after the referendum, we have a situation where it's generally believed, I think on good evidence, that basically Boris Johnson was using the referendum as part of his bid for the Tory party leadership. And, David Cameron, again, for really quite minor tactical reasons, called the referendum to assuage, get on side his UKIP tendency in the Tory party, and unintentionally created a massive change in British politics. So we have to trust people are doing things for the right reasons because they're the best thing for the country. And I think respect probably follows trust.
So in your book, Natalie, which would be, you say you're writing memoirs, so that would be an opinion of yourself, are you liked, trusted, or respected? Where on that spectrum do you fall?
You'd have to ask other people what they think of me. But I think in one of the things I say about all Green Party members, Green Party candidates, is that you can trust and believe that they're not doing this because they sort of fancied a job in a suit swanning around Westminster or swanning around their local town hall. We've shown with the election of Caroline Lucas in Brighton Pavilion in 2010 that we can get elected to any level around the country. Greens do get elected. We beat first past the post on a regular basis in local council elections. I'm confident that whenever the next election is, we'll beat first past the post in in more MPs' seats. But it's not the easy route. You have to work very hard. You have to be very good and very convincing to get people to vote for you.
Yeah.
So therefore, you actually know why people in the Green Party are doing what they're doing, why they're in politics. They're in politics because they care. They want to make a difference. And of course, there are people in all other parties who fit that criteria too. But you can be sure with the Greens that they weren't just looking for an easy route to the town hall or an easy route to Westminster. They were seeking to make a difference.
Sure, I understand the effort it takes to try and become a Green politician, and even more so when, at least it seems to me, the British seem to be resistant to Green policies. I mean, Green policies make sense to me, clearly they do to you, but there does seem to be that resistance still to the idea that the environment matters, that we can't just keep building our economies on infinite growth with finite resources. And, you know, especially with all the news lately about climate change, plastic pollution, what we're doing to our pollinators, yet that resistance is still there, isn't it?
Well, I think if you turn that question around and think about why has somewhere like Germany got so far on the energy transformation, why do we have stronger environmental protections in much of the rest of Europe compared to Britain? Why is Britain the one who always seems to be fighting within Brussels against improving the environmental standards? In all of those countries, there are Green parties with significant parliamentary representation, as yeah. Indeed we have significant parliamentary representation in Brussels, which again comes back to the electoral system. I'm afraid we keep coming back to that Greens have been parts of government in Germany. Greens are part of more, part of coalitions in state governments in more states than Angela Merkel's CDU is. So Greens have been able to have a place at the heart of government because of the electoral system. But more than that, I think it's really important to stress that, yes, we are talking about environmental issues, but we're also very much talking about social issues. That's Green Party political philosophical basis has always said that economic and environmental justice are indivisible. And if you think about the state of Britain, collectively, we're all, however you live as an individual, collectively, we're using the resources of three planets every year, our share of those resources. We only have one planet. So we have to come back to one planet living. But of course, there are lots of people in Britain who are struggling to put food on the table, skipping meals because they can't afford to buy them. People who switch the heating off in midwinter and shiver because they can't afford the bill. So you can't say to those people, oh, you have to cut back. And I think what we've seen, assisted by a right-wing media, is a sense that dealing with the environment is a luxury, oh, and that will hit poor people hard. But actually, what we have to do is allow some people to be lifted up to have more access to resources. And that means that people who are consuming a lot, which is broadly speaking the people, the 1%, and those who've really benefited from the boom while the majority of people have missed out, those people have to give up much more. So we need to get a decent standard of living for everybody. And I think one of the things that's increasingly obvious now is that the growth economy, the way we've been doing things, simply isn't working. And if you take just one figure that I think sums this up very well, the rate of depression among the under-16s has doubled in the past decade. Our young people are fearful about the future, worried about whether they can get a job they can build a life on, thinking they'll never be able to afford to buy a house, we'll have to keep renting with all the insecurity that currently entails. It hasn't delivered. Women in their 50s, I've done a lot of work with the WASPI campaign, Women Against State Pension Inequality. Women, many of whom have worked all their life, either in paid or unpaid roles, caring roles, then find themselves left in absolute poverty, stuck on job seekers allowance in their late 50s, forced to go on really unpleasant, useless courses on CV writing, thoroughly disrespected, living in poverty, and yet they've contributed to society all of their lives.
If I can just backtrack a moment, and I don't want to ignore that last point because it is very important, of course, but just while I'm thinking about it, even though, as you just said, the environment is incredibly important to all of us. We all depend on a healthy environment. It was hardly mentioned at the last election, and I don't remember any mention of it at all during the Brexit referendum discussions. Was that the media's fault or environmentalists' fault for not pushing the issues harder?
I think the environmentalists, particularly if we look at the referendum campaign, there was a very strong campaign being run by organisations like Friends of the Earth. Friends of the Earth, particularly, I'd note, did a lot of very good work on fisheries that was seen, you know, as a point of attack from the Leave campaign. Yet, as I was, and Friends of the Earth and others were making the point, if you look at the example of, if you were asking about democracy in Europe, the way the fisheries policies changed, in part because of green campaigners, you know, many of your people listening to this will have taken part in the campaign against discarding catch of low value.
Yeah.
The policy was changed to make discards illegal. That's exactly a model of how politics should work. You know, campaigning makes a difference, policies change. So I think, you know, the environmental movement broadly did a very good job of presenting the case of why Europe is protecting our environment. But, and this isn't just an issue about the environment. You think of how the media covered the whole referendum campaign. It was basically covered as a Tory leadership contest. It was about personalities. It was about, you know, one side the economy, the other side immigration. And a whole range of other issues simply weren't touched on, weren't discussed. So we have, you know, a media that is really is a problem. The domination it's not even a handful, a very small number of right-wing media tycoons. But, you know, the positive side of this is that social media is becoming much more important, alternative media, all sorts of different outlets are springing up now. The technology makes it, you know, almost anybody can now make the perfect 2-minute YouTube video, and if you just hit the zeitgeist, got the right issue across, and maybe you get tweeted by a celebrity, you can get a million views on that video. You know, tip, it probably includes some cute kitten pictures. So there is more underlying democracy in the system available to people than there has been previously. And that's one of the things I hold out as a hope.
You've just answered my next 6 questions on social media. On the fisheries argument, Natalie, the debate over discards, I followed that closely, and surely the real argument should have been that we are simply catching far too many fish in the first place.
Well, I think what Friends of the Earth said, and their experts looked at this, and they said, you know, very sadly, we just got to the point where European fisheries policy was just about getting towards sustainability. Not quite there yet, but vastly improved on what it was 10 or 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I argue with people from the fisheries industry, and, you know, basically saying, if we leave the EU, we'll be able to catch more fish. And my response to that was, no, you won't, at least not in the long term, because the number of fish you can catch is dependent on the number of fish that are there. And that is the biological limit. And that's, you know, it's very clear that both in terms of natural environment, wild species, everything. You mentioned plastics in the oceans. I've done a lot of work on microbeads.
I know you have,
We're butting right up against the planet's limits. You know, it's not just climate change. My first degree was agricultural science, so yes. I can get very geeky about soils. I won't do that to you now, but, you know, we are trashing our soils. It's said that, you know, as a kind of ballpark figure, we have 100 harvests left in British soils before they're entirely exhausted. Our industrial agriculture is one of the issues that I really want to work on when I step down as leader, because as leader, you've got to cover every topic under the sun. I'm hoping to be able to specialise a little bit more. And getting a sustainable, secure food supply is one of the issues of the coming decades. At the moment, we only produce about 60% of our own food, and only about 10% of our farmers would survive without subsidies. We've got a profoundly broken system of food production. You know, how do we restore the ring of market gardens around towns and cities? There's lots of, you know, really interesting community-supported agriculture projects, you know, little small-scale. You can produce an awful lot on a sort of 10 to 20-acre small vegetable farm, managed intensively in a good way, with lots of biodiversity, you know, lots of different species, lots of beneficial non-food species mixed in it. But at the moment, those kind of things are happening only on a tiny scale, and we need them on a mass scale. One of the most secure food supplies you can have is the food that just comes from down the road.
Yeah, yeah.
Freshest food, nicest tasting food, even extra bonus. So how do we make that transition is one of the things that I think we've really only just started to think about.
I was going to ask you about environmental sustainability, you know, especially as you brought up fishing. You said earlier that we're using up 3 times the resources the planet has to offer. I was going to ask you whether there is such a thing as environmental sustainability, the way that we use resources, but presumably you would say there is, and that the market garden model you just outlined is part of what you'd see as a sustainable use of what the environment has to offer.
Exactly. I mean, I'm not talking, to be clear, about autarky or anything like that. I do like my occasional cup of coffee, as I've just enjoyed, and we're not going to grow coffee in Britain anytime soon. If we get to that stage, we're in big trouble. You know, spice, bananas, yeah. But you know, really the bulk of the food on your plate most of the time should come from somewhere nearby. That just makes sense. And of course, you know, behind that is the whole problem of the supermarket model. The idea that you have a huge store which has tens of thousands of product lines, all of which are always in stock, including the fresh food and the baked goods and everything else, which implies a huge amount of waste. No seasonality, so you're shipping it from all around the world. You know, that whole supermarket model of food supply is both deeply fragile. The New Economics Foundation did a study basically saying that we're 3 days from disaster, because most people have 3 days of food in their kitchens, and supermarkets operate a just-in-time supply model. And also, environmentally, it's just immensely wasteful and immensely damaging.
I had a question written down that I was going to ask you, and actually it fits in very well with what you've just said. And it's it was based around a playful exchange in The Guardian last year where you met Conservative MP Jacob Rees-Mogg.
I remember it very well.
Well, he said, when asked why should people vote for you, he said that they should vote for you if they believe that we're on the cusp of an environmental catastrophe that will be solved only by a drastic reduction in our standard of living. Now, I think we probably both agree that we are indeed on the verge of an environmental catastrophe, but the green solution is always being sold by critics of warnings of cuts in our standard of living. Now, you mentioned overstocked supermarkets. The unfortunate truth is people seem to like overstocked supermarkets. It's again that feeling that no matter how sensible the argument, some people, are resistant to green thinking.
I would not agree with Jacob Rees-Mogg on this, as on many, many other issues. It's a question of we have to cut our resource use, but I would argue that we can actually have a better quality of life. What we're doing now,
which isn't the same as standard of living, is it?
Exactly. You know, consuming lots of resources. I've already, in a way, referred to this, the issue about depression rates among the under-16s. We're a stressed, fearful, worried, insecure society. I think, in a way, the referendum result shows this. And if you talk to people, people are deeply insecure and worried about the future. If you ask people, as they've been doing very regularly for decades, do you think your children and grandchildren will have a better life than you've had? The answer is increasingly negative. People get that what we're doing now isn't working. So what we can do is change the way we're doing things. And just a sort of practical example of this, I'm very taken with the New Economics Foundation, which has done a lot of work and continuing to do more work on the idea of reducing working hours. So Green Party policy is to reduce working week to a standard 35 hours. But New Economics Foundation has done quite a bit of work looking at how you might gradually, over a period of years, maybe even a couple of decades, reduce the standard working week to 21 hours, a three-day week roughly, as standard. And what you do is possibly people have less stuff in their life, but they have more life. You know, for example, every year you reduce the standard working week by 15 minutes. Over 4 years, you get an extra hour of life every week to do with whatever you like. Play with the grandkids, potter around in the allotment, read a book, watch the telly if you want to, play a computer game. You've got that life, extra life. And that can be a trade-off that says, my quality of life is improving. You know, I don't go and buy £5 T-shirts to go shopping on Saturday, but that's not really a great loss. And I think it's really interesting. I mean, I talk a lot to groups of people in the artistic community, and we desperately need people to make more creative works that picture a future that works out. There's way too many zombie movies in the world. And you know, apocalypse novels just seem to be coming out of our ears at the moment for reasons you can understand. But what we really need, I'd love someone to make a rom-com, a romantic comedy, you know, Hollywood, massive budget, great stars, whoever it is at the time. And in the background is a world where it's all worked out. you know, it's 2050, and the only person I know who's written a book like this is Jonathan Porritt, The World We Made. And I think even Jonathan himself would kind of admit that he's probably not a great literary figure. But he's painted a picture of a world in which his main character's a teacher. The teacher works, I think, a 24-hour week, does another day a week in the community garden, is a day volunteering in it as a school governor at another school. It's all solar-powered, wind-powered. It's all very green, environmentally friendly. The houses are beautifully insulated, and it's a comfortable, lovely life.
Is this a pitch for a potential career change?
No, I don't think romantic comedy is my natural area.
Natalie, we're about the same age, and you're talking about depression now, but I remember when I was growing up, the fear I had was of nuclear war. I mean, it's not entirely new, this fear that things are going to go cataclysmically wrong.
Well, of course, I'm afraid that the risk of nuclear war hasn't gone away, and that's one of the big political issues at the moment, that we're likely to be facing, you know, further votes on further decisions on replacement of Trident nuclear weapons. And that's, you know, a very negative thing in Britain, while at the same time we've got a very positive sign where we have 138 countries have signed up to work for a global ban on nuclear weapons. And while we're facing this, you know, huge environmental risks, wouldn't it be lovely if we could get rid of all of the world's nuclear weapons? That would free up quite a bit of money to help us deal with the environmental risks. You know, people often respond, oh, this is, you know, idealistic utopian. But picture the day, maybe 5 or 10 years hence, when there's buttons being pressed in Beijing, Washington and Moscow, and each one of those buttons is destroying each one of those countries' last nuclear weapons. The world would be a lot safer place, and one of the things we'd be able to do is focus more on the environmental issues that we need to tackle.
I don't think there's anything wrong with aiming for an idealistic utopia. I'm ready to sign up for that. Natalie, the elephant in the room is human population, isn't it? I mean, very few political parties will take on the issues of human population. Now, I haven't noticed a lot coming from the Greens on that either. I know you have policies, and I've read them, they're online. And I know you'll never be in favour of population control, but the simple fact is that the more of us that are, the more we're consuming, the more land we take up, the less space there is for the millions of other species on the planet. We are going to have to address this issue seriously at some point, aren't we?
Well, I think what we have to address is, as I've already referred to, one planet living. However many humans there are on the planet, they have to live with, each one of them has to live within the environments of one planet. That has to be the limit. Now, if you look at population, I mean, actually what's happening is in nearly every part of the world, population growth, number of children per woman has fallen off a cliff. And we know what happens is if you provide access to contraception, access to abortions, safe legal abortions, access to education, access to economic opportunities to women, all of those things result in a fall in the birth rate. My first politics was feminism. Feminism is, you know, where a lot of my passion comes from. And what we need to do is all of those things we need to do for human rights, pressing human rights reasons. So we should be doing all of those things, and those things that I talk about very often and campaign on very often. But if we're looking at, you know, what can we do today and tomorrow, and we've already agreed the problems we're facing are very urgent and very pressing. Population is what the population is now. What the issue is consumption.
Yeah, I was going to say exactly that. As even though, you know, the rate of increase in population is falling, the population is still growing. And what's tending to happen now is that people are tending to consume more and more across the globe.
What we need is the old green slogan of contraction and convergence. You know, there are still lots of people in the world who desperately need access to more resources, whether that's medical care, whether that's decent housing, whether that's transport. So we have to provide that for those people. We have to make sure those people have that available to them.
That is going to have an environmental impact.
But again, that's where we get to the contraction and convergence. We, in the West, broadly speaking, have to use fewer resources. But we can have a better quality of life. I mean, there's so many examples. The obvious one of home insulation. We have a problem with fuel poverty in Britain, not because we have particularly expensive energy, but because we have a really lousy quality of housing stock. Now, if we made a part of the National Infrastructure Programme to insulate and provide energy efficiency measures in every home that needs it, we create tens of thousands of jobs. We lift people out of fuel poverty, and we cut our carbon emissions. We make public transport affordable, reliable, convenient, running when and where you want it to. Not only do we create jobs, allow people to get around, cut congestion on the roads, we also tackle the pressing problem of air pollution, clearly improve our quality of life, reduce, end even the excess deaths from air pollution.
Is it incredibly frustrating to you that more people don't seem to understand this? I mean, it's really quite simple. We cut down a little on what we consume, we have a better quality of life, and the planet is saved.
Well, I think it's obvious in some ways when you look at those concrete examples. Seeing the whole picture isn't simple. And there is a real challenge for the Green Party and the environmental movement to boil this down into one sentence. And that's a challenge that I don't think... Perhaps we need more background information, people to be more aware of the issues, to be able to reduce it to one sentence. A better life, a secure life, that's what we're offering. And what I would say is that we are talking about environmental and economic justice. We're talking about people and planet. We're talking about how we live in a way that ensures everyone has a decent, secure life, can look to the future with confidence. And that means both tomorrow, being able to put food on the table, next week, keeping a roof over your head, in a decade or a century, keeping the planet in a livable condition.
Natalie Bennett, thank you very much and the best of luck.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Natalie Bennett, former party leader, speaking in August 2016. If you'd like more information about the Green Party, please go to greenparty.org.uk. Thank you very much for listening. And for more Lush Radio podcasts, please download the Lush Player app, which is available for both Android and Apple.